I'm Mel George, and I'm the president of St. Olaf College. And I've been doing a series this week on higher education. We started on Monday with a kind of overview of American higher education and a little bit of history, the various threads which have built American higher education, beginning with the Puritans and the liberal arts college model with the founding of Harvard in 1636. And then moved on through the Jeffersonian ideal of an educated citizenry to run a democracy, and the Land Grant Act, and the coming of the German research university model with Johns Hopkins in 1878, and then some of the explosion of higher education that's occurred since World War II. And then yesterday we talked a little bit about the financial arrangements in higher education, why does college cost so much, and financial aid. And I want to spend today talking about another major complex of issues in higher education. And then tomorrow we'll talk about the Lutheran colleges in America. And on Saturday, Interdependence Day, we are going to think about the church and its colleges and their interdependence. There are some really alarming things happening in the ELCA, in particular with regard to the colleges. And so I do have to warn you that maybe it's appropriate for July 4, but Saturday I will be on a slight soapbox, so I will try to be fairly objective today, but and tomorrow, but Saturday I'm going to orate. So if you're not interested in orations, Saturday would be a good day to miss.
That's fine for the fourth.
Huh?
That's fine for the fourth.
For the fourth, I may wave a flag even just a little bit. I want to talk tonight with you, and this is very much going to be a discussion, because the issues we're going to talk about tonight are not, there are no rights and wrongs. There are a few facts involved in what we're going to do tonight. And there are some things that we'll talk about that we may, I hope, have some divided opinion about. And I very much hope people tell me Holden is a place where people feel free to speak up and be open. And I hope that will happen tonight, because there are some issues on which I do not know my own mind fully on some of them, and so I really hope that you will contribute to this. All of the issues we're going to talk about tonight really derive from a major phenomenon in American higher education, and that is the fact that American higher education is faced with diversity. Now, of course, we all know what is happening in the abstract in this nation as a whole, but we are becoming a more diverse nation. Those of you who have children in grade schools may have seen the composition of the grade schools change over the last few years, depending on where you live. Ted, you're in California, you've seen this for quite a while. It may amaze you to know that even in the city of Minneapolis, which most people think about as being populated exclusively by Scandinavian white Lutherans, all of whom have migrated into the city from Lake Wobegon, that in fact the school district of Minneapolis is between 45% and 50% people of color. Does that surprise you? That surprises most people. The school district of the city of Minneapolis, I'm neglecting the suburbs, I admit that. And if you throw the whole Twin Cities area together, it's quite different. And I suspect in St. Paul it's not much different from that. I know the figure for Minneapolis is between 45 and 50, and my guess is for St. Paul it's about the same. That is astonishing. If you took your Swedish Lutheran grandmother or great-grandmother who died 30 years ago and showed her a typical school in the city of Minneapolis today, she would be astonished at the fact that those are not all nice, blonde, blue-eyed people in that school. And of course, as those kids move up the school system, higher education is going to feel that effect. If you look at the population of the United States of people who are 18 years old and under, the fraction of those who are people of color is increasing by about 0.5% every year. In the last two generations, the percentage of people of color in the under 18 year population has doubled, 3 in 10 people under 18 in this country are now people of color. In another 34 years, in 2025 or so, which is not very far away, half the people under 18 will be people of color. And your children may live to see the day when whites are a minority. Yes?
Who do you include people of color?
I'm including blacks, Hispanics, Native Americans, Asians. And these are not all equal groups by any means, but this isn't the time to talk about that. I mean, some are educationally much more advantaged than others and that sort of thing. But in terms of non-whites, by the year 2025, half the people under 18 in this country will be non-white. And that is a phenomenon that is affecting education at all levels and will affect higher education increasingly in the years to come.
Is that a common definition to include Hispanics and the people of color?
Yes.
Because they're... No.
That's a government... the government defines these, and that is a common definition, and they themselves consider... They consider themselves... Uh-huh. Minorities is the old word for people of color.
Oh, absolutely. Minority is something else. That's another government definition, but a lot of Spanish background. I mean, from Spain...
Well, some of them aren't. Some of them. It's been a long time since they were from Spain, and they're subgroups of Caribbeans. And yes, they very much consider themselves people of color. And if you think about even in higher education today, as of 1990, which is the latest figures for which I have the latest year for which I have figures, something like 21% of public and private higher education enrollment is now people of color. Only about 79% are whites, or if you want to be technical, whites other than Hispanics, because the Hispanics are included in people of color. And that's a new phenomenon. And that phenomenon in American higher education has produced four areas of stress. Four areas in which there has been divided opinion, four issue areas for higher education. And I'm going to write all four areas down before we talk about any of them, because they do overlap some, as you will see. The first area of stress is the question of support services. Many of these students, not all by any means, but many of these students come out of educationally deprived backgrounds. They come out of inner city environments in which schools and families were dysfunctional, virtually. And they come to a college without adequate preparation. What is the responsibility of higher education to work at that problem? That's really the first issue. How many resources should we provide in kind of remedial training things? And that doesn't only affect people of color, but that's a large fraction of the problem. And is that fair to our other students to take resources and devote to that kind of remedial work which colleges should probably not be doing? The next general issue is that of climate on campus. Issues of intolerance. And speech. What should a college do about a white student who walks up to a black and says, "Why did you come here, nigger? We don't want you here." Third kind of general issue, I'd like to talk about deals with the whole question of curriculum. What books should we teach? I think almost all of you will remember the controversy at Stanford. Poor old Stanford will be remembered for this for a long time. You know, how to go, hey, hey, ho, ho, Western Civ has got to go. Remember that when they were talking about revising their required Western Civilization course. And like most Western civilization courses, the reading list for that probably started with Homer. You know, and you read the Iliad and or the Odyssey or both. And then you probably had some from the Bible. Interesting, we ought to talk about, is the Bible a Western work? think about that for just a minute, but the Bible. Oh, and then there were all those guys like Sophocles, Euripides, Aeschylus, Dante, Shakespeare. You know that list. You all had the most of those books.
Should we still teach that?
Is that what we should still be teaching? And the fourth area, I heard a number of people say, does PC mean personal computers? No. Actually, it means political correctness. That's all right. You should know that those of us who were teaching were told under pain of death that we had to have titles that were only 40 characters. Dorothy, you put a little grace into this. You did say maybe 42, I think. But I had this wonderful title with political correctness in it. I started counting, and I got up to 65, so I had to stop. But political correctness is a topic which has been widely discussed in newspapers, Time Magazine, all those great scholarly journals like that. Ooh. And it's a very interesting and very difficult issue. I think I first heard the term when I was chairing an accrediting team at Oberlin College several years ago, and when I go to accredit an institution of higher education, I always find a student and say, take me to lunch and tell me about this place. And I remember vividly, I was sitting with him on the grass after lunch, and we were talking about some issue, and he expressed an opinion, and he said, but I can't say that here because it's not PC. And I said, I don't know what that means. And he said, opinions at Oberlin are either politically correct or they're not politically correct. And that opinion that I have is not politically correct, and so I don't say that here. And I thought, this is an institution in which ideas flourish and can be expressed. Well, you know, what is going on here? That was my first encounter with political correctness.
Just for curiosity, when was that?
I was trying to remember the year. It was in the 80s. Uh-huh. It was in the 80s for sure, and it would have been about 80, maybe 85 even. I'm sure the term existed, but you know, in the Midwest, we're sort of isolated. It probably existed on the coast. It moves about 150 miles a year. What I want to do now is, and you will see, obviously there is some relationship between these. There's obviously a connection between political correctness and the question of what curriculum you teach. I mean, some curricular choices can be politically correct and others cannot. There's obviously a connection between political correctness and the climate on campus. So there is some overlap here. But I want to go through each of these now, and I really want you to talk with me about some of these issues. Let's take support services. What is the responsibility of a college or university to take a student who can't write a complete English sentence and teach that student how to do it? Should we have admitted that student? First generation black from an inner city, never thought about going to college. Somebody turned her on at some point about the possibility of college. She shows up at your college, and it turns out she really doesn't know what a subject and a verb are. What do we do with her?
We've been doing that for years at colleges. Maybe the students want black women, but now the question is, do we continue to do it for maybe larger numbers of people? I mean, many colleges have been doing that, especially in areas of math and English.
Many colleges have been doing some.
Depending on their mission.
Depending on their mission and their location. Certainly junior colleges have done that a lot more than has Harvard or Berkeley or other places. But you're right. Many colleges have done some of it. But the numbers now are vastly increasing. You got as many answers as I do, I think.
It's a good question, I think, that they made the difference between private and public schools, too, universities. Because in private schools, when people pay high tuitions and see if I diverted towards doing things like this, it's an additional burden on the parents that pay tuition, which I know we just went through this, you know, at the regular universities.
So you've raised, I think, one of the real questions, and that is, fairness in terms of allocation of resources. If indeed there is a problem that is fundamentally not the colleges to meet, but a societal problem, is it the college's responsibility and its supporters, whoever those are, parents and donors, to solve that problem? Yes, Anne.
I think in some ways this is like a lot of things that develop to meet the needs of special populations, whether it's people of color or people with handicaps or anything else, that sometimes then you end up providing a service that benefits a lot of people, like late bloomers or people who didn't decide to late. And I think that sometimes that's just a side issue, but I think sometimes it can be a significant thing that really adds to the armamentarium that the higher education institution has to more than just what kind of the group that kind of brings the need to the attention of the college.
It is certainly true that providing special services, let's say, for a group of black students who arrive from an inner city, has in fact opened the eyes of colleges and universities to the fact that there are lots of other students who are having the same problem and may benefit from the same service. And that is absolutely correct. That is absolutely correct. The real problem, of course, is that this problem should have been solved before they get to college or university. I mean, that's the crux of the problem, is that it should have been taken care of in the 7th grade or the 9th grade or the 10th grade or the 11th grade. And now what do we do about this as a society if it's not? And that's the question.
You're so confused.
I'm confused, I guess. I remember when I applied for college and you have to write essays and hit your SAT scores and all this kind of thing. At what point does it say, well, are you poor and are you a person of color, and then we'll disregard this? I mean, have things changed about how you get into college these days?
In some cases, because there has been such an effort on the part of many colleges to reach out to students who might not have been traditionally admissible to college.
But if a woman, a white woman, 50 years old, who, you know, didn't get a high school graduate, high school diploma, would she then qualify for this? I mean, do we have all these specialized groups now that if you meet such and such a special requirements, other things are not paid attention to, scores and all? Can you get into college? Can anyone get into college these days if you're the right kind of minority, whether it's gender or
In America, anyone can get into some college. Anyone in America who has a high school diploma can get into some college. That's a fact. Because there are many institutions in America that have open admissions. They have no admission requirement whatsoever except for a college diploma. The City University of New York, a high school diploma. The City University of New York, for example, has no admission requirements whatsoever. None. Stanford does, but the City University of New York does not. But even in a Stanford or a St. Olaf or a Luther or where there has been a deliberate attempt for educational reasons to have a campus that is other than middle class white Westerners, many of those institutions have found themselves admitting students who might not technically have been admissible 10 and 15 and 20 years ago, when there was not that commitment to try to make campuses more inclusive. And so it's a little, it's not, there's no simple yes or no answer to your question. But it is true that there are more people on campuses now who are less well qualified than there were when you applied for college. That's a true statement.
When I think about a school like Oldham, and I wonder, since it was one of the first schools that admitted both women and African Americans, if they faced this question before, 100 years ago, and how they handled it then, because, you know, in this category of diversity, when I look at not so much support services, but certainly the other three, all relate to having women as part of the diversity. And what did Oakland do 100 years ago? They had separate tracks.
Mm-hmm. They had separate tracks, and of course, at least for the African Americans, the numbers were vastly small. And the number of African Americans probably who were going on to college was very limited to those who could go to Oberlin or Harvard or whatever.
I think 150 years ago,
yeah, Oberlin made allowances of the sort you're talking about in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. They made allowances because they valued
diversity.
Situation was important to them. I mean, there was slavery 200 miles to the south, okay. And they chose to do that, and they made allowances, and it was hard.
But the question is, as you pointed out, Patty, at the beginning, the question is, with vastly increased numbers and vastly increased demands, how much allowance can be made by higher education? And I think that is a legitimate and real and serious social question.
And probably vastly poorer secondary schools now in the United States.
Vastly poorer secondary schools for a whole lot of reasons.
There's like one school in Wisconsin, California there. And the valedictorian didn't pass an SAT and sued for a lack of education. Sued the school district. Valedictorian.
Wondering why he didn't sue his mother and father, too. That's another issue. Eleanor.
Would this harm the gifted students? I mean, if they'd be in the same class with the ones that are not as knowledgeable, they're in the same class?
I don't think there's any evidence that would harm them. It certainly is the case that in many schools, choices have to be made, resource questions arise. Do we fund more support services for the underprepared as distinct from honors programs for the truly gifted? I mean, those are the kinds of choices that you're faced with in this situation. Do we spend as much money to maintain small classes so the gifted can really participate and get, you know, do their thing? Or do we put more money into support services? I don't think it certainly is clear that a class benefits from having some very gifted people in it. But I don't think it's clear that a class suffers by having people who aren't gifted in it. So I wouldn't say that. Yeah.
How realistic is it to hope that perhaps the institutions of higher education would begin to work with the schools on the elementary and secondary school level to eventually try to do something about this problem so that colleges eventually would not be getting all of these people?
This woman has lived with me too long. I mean, where I am is that it is exactly this issue, and not just for people of color, but largely so. It is exactly this issue, which if goodness, common sense, and a conviction that the common good depends on it doesn't do so, sheer self-interest will force colleges and universities to start paying attention to elementary and secondary schools. I mean, I personally think it's a good thing for colleges and universities to be interested in the elementary and secondary schools because the common good depends on an educated citizenry. I am a Jeffersonian in the sense that I believe the common good depends on people being able to read a newspaper and figure out what the Supreme Court actually said on abortion, and if they don't like it, vote for a different president who will appoint different Supreme Court justices. But I think this issue, even if you don't think that's the business of colleges and universities, will force colleges and universities to reach out and establish connections which try to encourage elementary and secondary schools. Doug?
I can't give you a name of the names of corporations. It's my understanding that certain corporations have found that the availability of qualified entry-level workers is getting short enough so that they're doing some direct intervention by going into the schools and actually making sure that the corporation will prepare the students, even though the public schools are failing to do so.
Corporations, you're absolutely right, are taking a great interest in elementary and secondary education. They are sending executives out into the schools. They are giving money directly to schools. There's a massive shift in giving going on in this country that presidents of private colleges are keenly aware of. From corporations which used to support higher education are increasingly now focusing on elementary and secondary education. And I can't quarrel with that, frankly, because if we don't get that problem solved, we're all doomed.
Rick. Another dimension of the support services that colleges face is in recruiting minority faculty. Inspiration for the minority students that are coming on board. And then again, the quality question comes in. What standards do you hold your faculty to in terms of the quality of their education?
And how do you treat them once they get to your college? Do you put your single black faculty member on every committee in the college because you want to have a representative group? Yeah, as the academics in the room are loud, they know about this problem. No, that's a problem. I'm going to move on. Let's leave this one and move on. How many of you are aware of things that have gone on, for example, in the state of Wisconsin about rules and regulations about speech on campus? Are you aware of this? Well, if you're not, you ought to be. Several colleges and universities, University of Michigan, University of Wisconsin being among the chief examples.
Madison.
Yeah, but it's the system, Madison. It's a whole system. Passed regulations 2 or 3 years ago which attempted to ensure that students, particularly students of color, but not only that, women and gays and lesbians also, would be free from outlandish verbal harassment. I don't think I have to convince you that it is not a good thing for a black student to arrive on the campus of your college and have a white student walk up to him and say, "What are you doing here, you nigger? Why don't you go home?" That is not a thing that enhances community. It is not a thing that makes it possible for that young African American who is already feeling in the middle of an alien culture, ripped out of the surroundings that she knows, and in the middle of people who don't look like her. And to hear something like that is very destructive of her ability to learn. I think the most interesting experience Maida and I ever had was a trip to West Africa with some Lutheran college presidents 4 years ago, and we got on that wonderful airline Air Afrique in New York to fly nonstop to Dakar, and you get on the plane and there are 7 white people and 262 black people. And I mean, for the first time in our lives, we understood what it meant to be in a place where you were really different. And it doesn't feel comfortable. And so colleges and universities, as they have tried to bring people of color onto campus, have worried about how can we create a climate which lets them do their thing and learn and grow and develop free as much as we can from harassment. And so colleges and universities adopted rules and regulations about this kind of verbal behavior. I read to you from a recent issue of the Chronicle of Higher Education. The Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin has revised a hate speech rule that was struck down last fall by a federal judge. They passed a law that said essentially if you go up to a gay person and say you faggot you, you can be penalized by the university. You could be suspended, go through some sort of disciplinary process, and worst comes to worst, be expelled. And that was struck down by a federal judge on the basis that it was a violation of constitutional right to freedom of speech. The new rule, which bans certain types of epithets on University of Wisconsin campuses, may take effect before the fall semester. The rule defines offensive speech as that directed at an individual's race, sex, age, disability, or religion, and requires that the speech be likely to provoke, quote, an immediate violent response, unquote. The original rule, which Judge Warren said was unconstitutionally vague, banned a variety of other discriminatory behavior and did not include the provision about provoking a violent response. A group of students challenged the original rule, saying it violated their rights to free speech. Now, I think you can understand the difficulty of this issue. Colleges and universities are supposed to be places in which people can express almost anything they want to, except possibly yelling fire in a crowded theater. It's supposed to be a place in which there is a free exchange of ideas, no matter how outlandish. Remember, it was in a university that Martin Luther got up and started saying outlandish things. I mean,
he'd been tossed out today.
He might.
He would be.
Might. And yet, at the same time, you want to protect students from a kind of harassment that makes it impossible for them to learn. And so you have two competing goods. I mean, this is not a question of a good and an evil. It's a question of two competing values. Free speech, who can be opposed to free speech? Who can be opposed to non-harassment of individual people?
Yeah. It's interesting that this comes up under the rubric of diversity. We're thinking about the diversification of the campus population, but what it brings out is a diversity of views, and now we're trying to decide how to cope with that diversity of views.
Right.
When there's no longer a clear community standard about what speech is acceptable. It's very interesting, a couple weeks ago we had a session about homophobia, and we were invited to fill in these epithets for different types of people, and there were several people in the room at the end, and said, my goodness, oh, and the woman who was leading it said, now don't be polite. Say whatever comes to your mind. And several people afterwards said, my goodness, I learned a lot of new words. Because the communities in which they live are, if it wasn't that they were trying to be polite, but they didn't say them, because their community is so polite, they don't know those things at all. So that it's not just the diversity of the population, it's the diversity of opinions about those people.
And you're absolutely right. It's funny, in a way, growing out of an attempt to make a college or university more diverse in terms of population, we are now thinking about should we make opinions less diverse, at least expressed opinions, and that's a very important phenomenon. Are you aware that the federal government is considering a law to regulate speech on college and university campuses? This may come as quite a surprise to you. The Senate Committee on Labor and Human Resources has again rescheduled its hearing on the Freedom of Speech on Campus Act, introduced by Senator Larry Craig of Idaho last year. The proposed hearing is now tentatively, I guess hasn't been scheduled, it was originally scheduled for June 16, and it's been postponed. This bill would amend the education amendments of Title IX by adding language that would prohibit any institution of higher education that receives federal funds, and that's virtually every institution in the country. Grove City College is about the only institution I know that turns down all federal funds, would prohibit any institution of higher education from discriminating against any student on the basis of protected speech. Craig said he introduced his bill because some colleges and universities are using federal funds to impose, quote, prior restraints on speech by taking actions such as instituting behavior codes and harassment policies that require politically correct speech with the effect of suppressing unpopular viewpoints. if this law passes, the University of Wisconsin would not have been permitted to establish such a code. The law would say a college and university essentially can't take any action to limit the expression of these kinds of epithets.
See, that will play itself out differently if you look at institutions that are closely linked to certain faiths, like Baptist College or biblical colleges, where you sign a code saying that you won't use certain language, you won't do X, Y, and Z, you won't engage in certain behaviors while you're a student there. And as a private college right now, they can do that, correct? They can have this moral code that students actually sign off of. So under this law, because most of those colleges get federal funding, they would no longer be able to do that?
No, I think they could still do that. It's just they would not be able to adopt a rule that says you may not use language that demeans a person's gender or racial background. That's the kind of rule they could not impose.
They can probably always, a person can always give up their rights under the law with something like the provision she's talking about.
That's an interesting question. I'm not a lawyer, but I've been told that it's actually quite difficult to give up your rights. That in fact, even if you sign, you know, if you're going to go on a ski lift or something, and you sign a little thing that says, I give up my right to sue in case this ski lift breaks and I die, I think that actually is not legal.
You go work for a company, you sign away rights under patents just to get a job.
I think if you found a good lawyer, you might find that not all those things you signed away. I'm not sure you can actually sign away certain rights anyway.
Yeah.
Here I go practicing law without a license, which I better not do.
The reason I brought that up is because often, one Bible college I worked with, they inhibit certain language. I mean, they're very specific about, you know, not using certain swear words, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, that part might get
And that's, yeah, I mean, that addresses language and right. Thing. I'm not sure that's what they had in mind, but yeah. It would affect those people.
That part of it, I think, Patty, would be in some trouble if this law passes. But it's interesting. I mean, this is an interesting tension. And again, I'm not entirely clear how I feel about this. I think generally, I take the view that to try to regulate speech is probably unproductive. That one must take a very positive stance toward the way we should speak on this campus, provide all sorts of educational things, provide outlets for people who have been abused, who have been called a faggot, to come to a group who can try to not only support them, but get to the people who did that and really try to force them to understand how difficult this was. But I guess, without having clearly come to this conclusion in my own mind, I think I'm in favor of a more proactive stance about the ways in which we should relate to people, and less a regulatory stance about the things we should not say. But it's a very difficult issue. Yes.
Is that the sort of approach that sometimes is called sensitivity training, or
for example,
teaching like that? Yeah.
For example.
Would that be some giving courses in the area? Is that something you would do?
Take all the new students as they come in for orientation, and you have role-playing workshops with them in which the hurt that is caused by calling a woman a broad. I don't know, is the term broad even used anymore? That dates me to that, but I mean, that was
not nicely.
Well, I mean, it wasn't nicely used when I was PC.
Track and field has changed.
But this points out, whether you're in favor of regulation or not, the education of the students who are at a diverse school is expanded, and they learn things about life in a more pluralistic society, which some of us did not learn in college.
Right.
And that shows one of the values that comes, even though it's difficult.
This is what I said, why so many colleges, for educational reasons, were reaching out to bring people of a different kind, because you cannot educate, even in Northfield, Minnesota, you cannot educate a Minnesota Norwegian Lutheran for the world of 2050 without their coming to understand what the rest of the world is like. You can't do that.
And I think it also makes us think about the educational mission. If a student can read and write and quote Shakespeare and do math and all of those things, but thinks it's all right to hate people, have we fulfilled our mission?
Right.
Yeah, maybe from a slightly different direction. I see the possibility because of the diversification of America, that America could find itself in the same position that Yugoslavia is in today, not because that these ethnic groups have always existed and have been artificially melded into one, but because they have existed and then grown together and have somehow a need to pull themselves apart so that each can be their own free, separate group, separatism. Separatism seems to be rising in America.
I think that's right. I think separatism is rising in the world. And, it's not easy to see where all this is going to go. I am also a great believer, though, in the fact that the worst possible prediction of the future is to have a linear extrapolation of what's going on now. I mean, that's almost never been the case. If you just say, let's take what's happening now and double it for the next 20 years, it's almost for sure not going to be that. But what it is, I don't know. But that gets us, thank you for that transition, gets us into curriculum. This is very much, one of the questions is the extent to which a curriculum ought to reflect this separateness or ought to be a kind of unifying thing that will bring people together around a common core of shared knowledge, experience, books. What should we teach? Should we stop teaching Dante and Shakespeare in order to make room for other voices? Yeah.
This is sort of a thing that is maybe broader than this, but in the New York Times a couple of years ago, there was an article on the growing knowledge about the different kinds of intelligence there are, and that most of our education is aimed at one or two of these types of intelligence. And I wonder if there's anything to be said for, and this relates back to support services too, for institutions of higher learning to start being in the forefront of trying to address the narrow range of intelligence that we tend to focus on in our education at this point. And this would go to both curriculum and support services. But there's part, I think our traditional Western education has tended to focus on just parts of what human intelligence or gifts or all that is. And so, again, one of the benefits possibly might be for some of our best minds to start struggling with, well, what have we tapped with traditional curriculum and what haven't we tapped?
I think that's right. I think if Bob Schultz were here, he would say, you see, you're supporting the arts and the music and art, and I quite agree. I think that's, let me just put in a slight plug, one of the things that I think is true about a residential college is that the kind of learning that occurs is much broader than just goes on in kind of book learning, as we might say, and that one's social intelligence, if you like, one's value sensitivity, all have chances to grow as well. So I think there's a good deal to what you said. But let's, for the sake of argument here, let's just suppose we're teaching a sort of standard English course. I mean, it's in the humanities that we really have these questions. What should we teach?
Well, the way you brought it up earlier, one listening could say it's mutually exclusive. It's Dante or a great writer from China, or it's Dante or a great writer from Africa. And the notion that there are great writers are all over the world, but we just haven't heard about them. There are great writers who look nothing like me, who grew up in this country. And I was sort of cheated out of those folks because I didn't know about those folks in my curriculum. You know, that's detrimental to some of the values I was taught about this country, for instance, and the role it has in the world and the way it's very democratized and all those things. So the notion of the best, if we really want folks to learn the best of the best, and academicians will debate for years, that's their job, what the best is. But the notion of pulling the best...
They certainly will.
No, that's their job. But the notion of pulling of seeking a bigger pot to pull the best from, I think is the approach that seems to be working at some places where people have this discussion.
You made a very important point, and that is that these arguments sometimes are presented as sort of, pardon this illusion, as black versus white choices. I mean, we either have all these old Western white guys, or we have, a Chinese women poets of the 12th century that no one ever heard of before. And that's not really the choice. One of the important points, I think, for anybody thinking about this issue to keep in mind is anytime any teacher gives any course whatsoever, that teacher makes choices about what to include in it. I made a choice about what to do at Holden in these 5 hours. I had 5 hours to cover all of higher education, and I made some choices as to what to talk about. Any teacher teaching an English course might choose to do Melville and not Dante, both white male guys. You see, but there was a choice made. So does that mean that Dante isn't any good? No, it doesn't mean Dante isn't any good. It just means you can't teach anything, everything. And besides, we still live in this faint hope that what students are actually going to do is learn how to learn, and they go out and go into the library and say, golly, I've got 12 million more books to read. Where do I start? You know, I mean, that's sort of the whole point is that your learning is not confined to the assigned reading of the curriculum. I mean, it may be a faint, dimly burning glimmer, but so that's one very important point that I think we must keep in mind. Every course involves choices. What else do you think about this, Deanne?
Well, as you were pointing out, every course is only part of the whole, and that is, as educators, we have to have some humility about the fact that we can't do everything. And so to always, I think, show our students that we've made those choices and that there are other things out there, not to fall into the impossible goal of trying to cover everything.
Right.
Whether that's the old canon or a new canon, the whole canon will never fit in any one course.
That's absolutely right. I want to go back for just a minute to Patty's point about choosing the best. I don't want to get into a discussion about particular works, which are better, which are best. But if someone said to you, what would be the criteria, one or more, that you would use to decide which books, and let's stick to literature for just a minute, which works of literature are the best? I don't want to hear the names, but what criteria would you use? New York Times bestseller list? Probably not. How would you decide? What would you think about as you thought about? I like that term the best.
Universality.
Universality, and tell me more. I think you're on
application beyond the particular period in which they were written, and more to human beings in as broad a sense as possible.
Ah. If I had a prize, I would award it. I mean, I think that what we ought to be looking for are works that really help us understand what does it mean to be a human being.
The notion of critical thinking. I mean, if you can get students to talk about that because they read a novel, if you can get them to ask those questions, that's amazing on a given day.
So a work ought to have some ideas in it. Yeah, I think so. But I really like this notion of universality. We ought to be looking for things that illustrate the great human and the common human. I mean, you know, we all have dreams and fears and anguishes, and we've all wrestled with questions of hatred and love and greed and how you organize society, and those are the kinds of things that we ought to be looking for, and that's what I would hope that best means. And if that means Shakespeare, even though he was a white male, terrific. And if that means the 12th century, you know, the first known poem in Chinese, and I don't think anybody even knows whether it was written by a man or a woman. The first known poem in Chinese is a wonderful, I don't remember the words, Maida, but it's about a farmer, and he or she is, this poet is saying, what does it matter to me what the government thinks Beijing is so far away? And this was like 2500 BC, this notion that away from the central authority, you have more freedom than when you're close to the central authority. I mean, there's a kind of, that really connects me. One of the things I like to do sometimes, I'm asked to give what would be my last lecture. And I go into the dorm and I talk about Mozart and all sorts of things. I begin with the cave paintings at Lascaux, because for me, the notion that people who lived 16,000 years ago, who had lifespans of perhaps 25 or 26 years, whose entire survival occupied almost all of their energy, that they went out and made wicks and lamps and oil and built scaffolds and stood up there in those caves and painted. What does that tell us about being a human being? I mean, I'd put that in my humanities course. Mark.
I resonate very much to what you have just been saying, but I do think that it's important in this context, the way you've set up these problems, to recognize that precisely what is, I think, most fundamentally at issue in a lot of academic discourse today is whether or not it even makes sense to ask the question, what does it mean to be human? That is, a whole range of people would say it makes sense to ask the question, what does it mean to be Javanese? What does it mean to be South African? What does it mean to be a lower class 13th century woman Basque fisherman, fisher person? But it, you know, in other words, what's precisely at issue is whether or not the concept of humanity has any coherent standing, or whether or not people like you and me have said what it means to be human when we are drawing simply on dead white European males or Shakespeare, etc. And it's not just a matter of now broadening the canon to include more voices. It's much more fundamental. It's the claim that things are so relativized that the best we can do is to take a kind of cultural inventory of what it means to be Javanese, what it means, etc., etc. So I think we should recognize that that contested issue is behind an awful lot of these other issues that you've introduced.
I think that's absolutely right. And for me, I would say that to know what it means to be human is very much to know that to be human means to be part of a smaller group as well, which has important characteristics which are to be honored, and that's the way I would connect those. Mm-hmm. Because to be human is not to be part of a homogenized mass. That's what's really changed, I think, in education in the last 30 years, is the realization that to be human is not to be like every other person who says, I'm human. And so I would say, I absolutely agree, but I would argue to the person who wants to leave out this question, mm-hmm. that in fact, the other issue is subsumed in a necessary way under what it means to be human. But you're right. Mm-hmm. I want to just read, there are lots of other issues in curriculum we could talk about, including history. I don't know what you probably saw. There was a big issue of Time magazine. I'm quite behind, and my wife makes fun of me because I'm usually running about 10 months behind in Time magazine. It saves all sorts of time because you can skip over all the current news sections. But I just got up to Gorbachev leaving the Kremlin. They had a wonderful issue called Who Are We? You may have remembered. I think this was probably last July 4th, a year ago, on the cover. What sort of nation are we now flying under this flag? And in the next issue, there were some letters, and I simply read you two in order to illustrate the two sides of this curricular issue. As an educator, I strongly resist the inclination to rewrite history to include today's divergent cultures. An individual with critical thinking skills, there you are, Patty, is aware of facts and perspective and knows the difference. That American history was written by white males is part of history itself. Interesting sentence. Blacks want history to reflect their struggles more accurately, while women would like to see more women's issues and experiences explored. So whose views will be called the truth? Women's, men's, blacks, whites, Asians, Catholics, Jews, gays, there's your question mark. Now, the very next letter is this. It is wrong to assume that the old method of teaching American history has not had harmful results. We African-American students have found it important to ensure that the vision of the past not be distorted. In the fifth grade, when my class studied the Civil War, our teacher stated without equivocation that the slaves were better off because they were given civilization and religion. She also told us that blacks were happy because they were well cared for by their masters. She neglected to describe the bitter dehumanization produced in both victim and perpetrator. There was no discussion of slave insurrections, lynchings, whippings, or families broken up and sold. Those who argue against political correctness obviously have not shared my historical experience. So the two very interesting letters, which leads me, he said, moving right along to 3 minutes worth of political correctness. What does political correctness refer to? What makes something politically correct or not politically correct? Community standards. What is the community? I'll tell you a story that goes back 10 years, Maida, to Northwestern University.
About that.
A Contra was going to speak on the campus of Northwestern University. My alma mater, Maida's alma mater, so we watched the news from there through the alumni magazine. And an untenured assistant professor of English, a woman who was the leader of a left-wing political group on campus, decided that this person should not be permitted to speak, that this person's views were so awful, so horrible, so revolting, so unacceptable, that this person should not be allowed to make his speech. So she and some students who were associated with her stood at the front door of the building in which this Contra was to speak with a can of pig's blood. And as he came up to make the speech, she threw this can of pig's blood all over him, which did sort of put a damper on the evening. And they she and her people then sort of took over the hall. And he left to go take a shower and never gave his speech. And she claimed that, she didn't use the words politically correct, I think that was probably before that phrase came into existence, but she claimed essentially that his speech was not politically correct, and hence it should not be permitted on the campus of Northwestern University. Northwestern later denied her tenure, not explicitly on those grounds, but they did not make any pretense of the fact that her behavior they found antithetical to the nature of university, and she should not remain as a part of that community. What do you think about that?
This goes back to your point B, really, tolerance on campus.
Partly, although here that is correct, and I said there was overlap. In this, we were referring more to attacks on individuals, and here we're talking more about ideas, but it absolutely does relate. Episode number two, you know the name Carol Iannone? Anybody know that name? On one side were such conservative heavyweights as Vice President Dan Quayle, columnist William Buckley, and Lynn Cheney, chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Lined up in opposition was an imposing array of scholarly dreadnoughts, including the Modern Language Association of America and the American Council of Learned Societies. At issue was the nomination of Carol Iannone, 43, a conservative literary critic to the NEH's 26-member National Council, which advises the National Endowment for the Humanities on spending its $170 million a year budget. The Senate Labor and Human Resources Committee voted 9-8 to scuttle the nomination. Senator Edward Kennedy contended that her scholarly credentials were too feeble to justify promotion to the council, whose charter required members with records of scholarship or creativity. A respected teacher of literature at New York University, Iannone earned her PhD at the State University of New York at Stony Brook with a 1981 dissertation that was sharply critical of feminism. As her critics note, Iannone has published little scholarly work since then. but that may have been less relevant to her nomination's fate than the currently unfashionable quality of her critical reviews, many of which have appeared in the Conservative Monthly Commentary. In March, she argued that a signal reason why so many top prizes had been awarded to recent novels by Gloria Naylor, Toni Morrison, and Alice Walker was not literary merit, but the fact that the authors were black and female.